Morning. We will continue our study in the book of Acts, and hopefully this time, it was my hope last time and I failed utterly, hopefully this time we will actually finish the book of Acts. I do want to revisit something. Bill and I talked a little bit about this afterwards, and we talked quite a bit about the temple and Paul's visit to the temple in, what would this be? This would be Acts 21. Something I spent a little bit time in the nature of the vow. And I was thinking about how Paul's attitude towards the temple might be in Acts, did some more reading. And there's a few things I want to read. That starts with the book of Numbers. So if you would turn back to Numbers chapter 6. There's general agreement that when it talks about this vow in Acts 21, that Paul purifies himself for, and the other people that were with him, that he would, that they had been purifying themselves, and that Paul would pay their expenses. What would expenses be in that case? And so let's go actually look back at number 6 at the nature of the Nazarite vow and see what those might be. It is, once you go back from here, it read fairly clearly what the expenses would be. So, Numbers chapter 6. And Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when either a man or a woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazarite, to separate himself to Yahweh, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar made from the wine or strong drink, and shall not drink any juice of grapes or eat grapes, fresh or dried. All the days of his separation he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine, not even the seeds or the skins. All the days of his vow of separation no razor shall touch his head, until the time is completed for which he separates himself to Yahweh. He shall be holy. He shall let the locks of his hair and his head grow long. All the days that he separates himself to Yahweh, he shall not go near a dead body, not even for his father or for his mother, or for brother or sister. If they die, shall he make himself unclean, because his separation to God is on his head. All the days of his separation, he is holy to Yahweh. And if any man dies very suddenly beside him, and he defiles his consecrated head, then he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing. On the seventh day he shall shave it. On the eighth day he shall bring two turtle doves or two pigeons to the priest to the entrance of the tent of meeting. And the priest shall offer one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering and make atonement for him, because he sinned by reason of the dead body. And he shall consecrate his head that same day and separate himself to Yahweh for the days of his separation and bring a male lamb a year old for a guilt offering. But the previous period shall be void, because his separation was defiled." So he had said he would separate himself as a Nazarite, and purely on accident, not of his own fault in any way, he comes in contact with a dead body. What do you do? Well, he's going to essentially end his separation at that point, shave his head, bring two turtle doves, and then start again to redo it. So, there you go. Okay, so that was, I think, what's going on there. "And this is the law for the Nazarite. When the time of his separation has been completed, he shall be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting, and he shall bring his gift to Yahweh, one male lamb, a year old without blemish for a burnt offering, and one ewe lamb, a year old without blemish as a sin offering, and one ram without blemish as a peace offering, and a basket of unleavened bread, loaves of fine flour, mixed with oil, and unleavened wafers smeared with oil, and their grain offering and their drink offering. And the priest shall bring them before Yahweh and offer his sin offering and his burnt offering, and he shall offer the ram as a sacrifice of peace offering to Yahweh with the basket of unleavened bread. The priest shall offer also its grain offering and its drink offering. And the Nazarite shall shave his consecrated head at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and shall take the hair from his consecrated head and put it on the fire that is under the sacrifice of the peace offering. And the priest shall take the shoulder of the ram when it is boiled, and one unleavened loaf, one of the basket, and one unleavened wafer, and shall put them on the hands of the Nazarite after he has shaved the hair of his consecration, and the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before Yahweh. They are a holy portion for the priest, together with the breast that is waved and the thigh that is contributed, and after that the Nazarite may drink wine. This is the law of the Nazarite. But if he vows an offering to Yahweh above his Nazarite vow as he can afford, in exact accordance with the vow that he makes, then he shall do in addition to the law of the Nazarite. And so that was the regulation of the Nazarite. They could, in fact, do more, but that was the basics. You will grow your hair out, and you will consecrate yourself. You will keep yourself pure from dead bodies, anything involving wine, grapes, and so forth. And then at the end, you would come and you would bring sacrifice to the temple, and you would shave your head, and the head shaving would be a part of that consecration. Okay, so that's the Nazarite vow in number 6. Now let's go back to the book of Acts. Acts 21. Call the context. Paul is coming back to Jerusalem. He is about to go to Rome, slowly, but about to make his way ultimately to Rome. He is coming back to meet with the Jerusalem church, and, for example, with James. And so we see in Acts 21, when we, and this would be Luke and Paul and the companions, when we had come to Jerusalem, the brothers received us gladly. On the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. And after greeting them, he related one by one the things that God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. When they had heard it, they glorified God, and they said to him, "You see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed. They are all zealous for the law. And they have been told that you teach all the Jews who among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or walk according to our customs. What then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come. Do therefore what we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take these men and purify yourself along with them and pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads." So this is the connection to the Nazarite vow. What are the expenses of the Nazarite? Probably not the shaving. The expenses, right, would be the sacrifices, right? You've got three sacrifices there. That's why there was that whole animals and money trading stuff around the temple complex, because not everyone would always have their own lamb and all that. And so they could pay for those things and bring those as a sacrifice to the temple. And so what James is saying here is, Paul, essentially, join the Nazarite vow with them. Purify yourself. All right? Purify yourself. Go with them and pay their expenses, and I would assume also your own, so that you can show the people there that you're not telling all of the Jews all over the world to stop obeying the law of Moses. Which, actually, this would be a really good way of doing it, right? He's going to go into the temple, and he's paying for something in the sacrificial system. And so that is interesting. And as Bill and I were discussing, if you compare that to the book of Hebrews, who definitely comes out quite clearly and says, you know, the blood of bulls and goats do not take away sin. And you also take that and compare that to the Olivet Discourse, where Jesus says, you know what, this temple is full of robbers, and it will ultimately be destroyed. It's an interesting contrast, because you've got the apostles and the early church leaders, not only here, but earlier in the Acts, going to the temple to do their activity. What is the nature of their relationship to the temple? It's interesting and a bit ambiguous, but here it seems to be positive. James going to the temple and sending people under Nazarite vow, presumably those who were Christ followers, Nazarite vow to the temple. Also, reading back through the end of Acts, I noticed a few other verses. And so if we look at Acts, let's see, 24, goes shortly after this, and you know, this is jumping ahead. Shortly after this, Paul gets in trouble with the Jews. And there's a few places where Paul describes his temple experience. And they're right here in 24. So this is Paul before Felix at Caesarea. if we go down to like verse 10 in Acts 24, and when the governor had nodded to him to speak, Paul replied, "Knowing that for many years you have been a judge over this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. You can verify that it is not more than 12 days since I went up to worship in Jerusalem. And then they did not find me disputing with anyone or stirring up a crowd either in the temple or in the synagogues of the city. Neither can they prove to you and now bring up against me." So in other words, how does he describe what he was doing in the city? Well, he went up to worship. Where would you go up to where, you know, physically, where would you go up to worship in the city of Jerusalem? What's up, right? The temple. That's what he's talking about. So when he describes going to the temple, he is describing it as an act of worship. And then let's read a few more verses on. Verse 14, "But this I confess to you, that according to the way which they call a sect, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written by the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men themselves accept, that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. So I always take pains to have a clear conscience toward both God and man. Now after several years, I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings. While I was doing this, they found me purified in the temple without any crowd or tumult." And so what was Paul's goal? To go to Jerusalem. He mentions two here. One, bring alms. And that's, you know, his famous collection that he talks about so much in his letters. Of he's going around the Asian and the Mediterranean world getting money to bring to relieve the Christians in Judea from famine. So that's one, is to present alms. The other one is to give offerings in the temple. From the perspective of Acts, this the Christians and at least temple worship never seems to be at odds. Now, something to also throw into the mix is, you know, returning to in terms of the book of Hebrews, and this has to do also with how you would date the book of Hebrews, is the book of Hebrews doesn't talk about the temple. Have you ever noticed that? That's not what it's talking about. It's always talking about the tabernacle. Now, I'm assuming this is because the regulations in the Old Testament law that he's going through are, well, they were originally for the tabernacle. The temple was something that came later and sort of became a tabernacle that never moved. But he is always talking about the tabernacle. Does that have any relevance to how he would view the temple? You know, people argue about various things. Like, when was the book of Hebrews written? Was it written before AD 70? Or was it written after AD 70? And it's terribly hard to know. You could say, on the one hand, well, it was written after AD 70 because it doesn't talk about the temple. The temple was destroyed by that time. And so therefore, he just talks about the tabernacle. But you could also say it was written before AD 70 because if it was written after AD 70, what would be the best argument for the fact that God has set aside the sacrificial system? That God destroyed the temple. And so God clearly set aside the sacrificial system. And so the book of Hebrews is an interesting thing to put into this mix. And this is one reason why it's always good to, whenever you're trying to construct some sort of understanding of how the New Testament fits together and the theology of it, this stuff in Acts tempers some of what I might would try to read in Paul. Because we've got here a narrative that clearly puts not only Paul, but the Judean church in not a state of antagonism to the temple. They clearly had some issues with the early Judean, some of the Judean Jews. All right, clearly there was antagonism there. Lots of chief priests and people like formerly Paul would try to arrest them and sometimes kill them. So there's clearly antagonism there, but there doesn't seem to be antagonism towards the temple. So, you know, this is, you know, Bible study is hard work, actually. It's not a huge book, but it is kind of big. And it takes a while to put some of these things together. Another thing that we should always think of, and this really goes back to our discussion last week as well, is sometimes it's, generally speaking, it's probably a better idea to base theology off of explicit statement as opposed to narrative. And I think this goes with some of the stuff that Bill was saying in terms of, like, for example, you've got Paul's instructions to women and whatnot. You've got narrative describing one thing, but then you have explicit instruction. This is why this shouldn't happen, and here's my specific biblical reason why. That, in general, is a little bit more clear than an exposition of a narrative, because narrative might just be describing what happened, not what should happen. That should be something that is in the mix whenever we're doing our Bible study. So when you go to say, okay, what should be the Christian's relationship to the temple, or if for some reason they rebuild a temple in Jerusalem, what should the Christian relationship to that and the sacrificial system be? We have quite explicit instruction and ideas in not only Paul, but especially in the book of Hebrews, right? Do we need a sacrificial system? No, we quite clearly don't need a sacrificial system. Did some of the early Christians continue to give offerings in the temple? It appears to be the case, but it's also quite explicit from the book of Hebrews, especially, no. We don't need to be offering some sort of offering in a temple. It's not appropriate anymore, right? That time is past. So, anyway, those are just some thoughts to finish up some of that. And also just a note about why it's always good to not only read the Bible, but also reread and reread. Because as I read through Acts again, reading through it based on our conversation last time, I'm like, oh, you know what? This is relevant for that. Oh, you know what? This is relevant for that. And that's kind of the nature of things. As you read through a book, it's not like we're perfect readers and we actually gather all of the information that first time through. At least I'm not. I go back and I read it again, you know, and as I'm reading through, I'm always constructing some sort of narrative, some sort of framework to understand the whole. And you read it again, you find something else that fits into that narrative, and you go, okay, well, maybe I am understanding this right. And then sometimes you go through and read it again, and you go, oh, I didn't notice this before, and I've built up this sort of framework for understanding what's going on, and then I read this, and that doesn't fit, so maybe I need to revisit my framework. A lot of that can only happen through multiple readings. Because as you try to piece it together and you try to piece through, especially, you know, our epistles that have an argument flow through them and whatnot, that repeated reading can be very valuable for trying to understand the flow of argument and the ideas there. So whenever you're doing your Bible reading, as we do this survey, don't read, you know, we're going to do Thessalonians next. Don't read Thessalonians once. Read Thessalonians once, and then the next day read Thessalonians again, and the next day read it again. That one's short. Acts is a little bit harder to read through once a day. Thessalonians actually wouldn't be. It's quite a short book. So, anyway, any thoughts? I do want to bring that discussion to a close so we can finish Acts, but those are some thoughts I had after the fact. I don't know all the answers. I don't know how to reconcile all those things. We discussed, you know, perhaps, you know, what's the distinction between James and Paul and whatnot in works last time as well. There's multiple things going on. You've got some writers that are more clear than others. You've got different people using the same words and not meaning the same thing. That's fine. It's actually normal, a human conversation for people to do that. You've also got this idea of development. They may not have come at this point really to the conclusion, oh, you know what? It is inconsistent for us to be sacrificing in the temple. That is an entirely reasonable explanation for this, that they just hadn't thought it through yet. What's the answer? I ultimately don't know. I wish I knew all the answers, but I don't. And I try not to pretend to know them all, but I fail there. Sometimes do. Yeah.
I think you would see that with Abraham too, when Paul, when God revealed himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was trying to change and do what God wanted, but were there inconsistencies? Certainly. You know.
Yeah.
And I think there's like a grace period, it seems like.
Yeah.
Okay, Jesus is not in the tomb anymore. Whoa. Worshiping the true God, we wouldn't abandon the temple. Why would we do that? Because we're worshiping the true God. This is just more on top of that truth that we already have.
Yeah.
And then realizing some of the inconsistencies later.
Eric, I think there's also a principle here, and that is, you know, whenever Samuel reviews the sons of Jesse, God says man looks on the outward appearance, but God looks on the heart.
Yeah.
And the principle is that God sees the heart, and sometimes we don't know the right thing to do. And it reminds me of an incident that I think was instructive to our church. Many years ago, we sent literature and tapes and books and stuff to a prisoner. Some of y'all remember this, and he was thankful. I wrote several letters that were read to the church, and then finally, you know, he had some amount of release, and so he could work in a workshop, and he was very thankful for what we had done for him. And so he prepared and painted and sent us a little statue of Jesus that he had made, and we got it. And for years it was back in the back room there on the bottom shelf, and we could say, that's idolatry, how could you? But it was ignorance, it was thankfulness. So did God see that he wanted to honor us and thank us? He was just not fully instructed? I think so.
Yeah, I agree.
And important question, this is more of a transition time.
Yeah.
In this generation, but when the temple was destroyed within 10 years, I guess there's never been another sacrifice in the Jewish religion. They don't sacrifice anymore. Is that another temple, so they don't do it, I guess.
Right. You've got in the rabbis where they basically, the synagogue replaces the sacrifice, and specifically not just the synagogue, but the reading of the Torah, the reading and studying of the Torah becomes the new central way of worship. And so it seems, what's their biblical basis for that? I mean, there isn't any biblical basis for that. But for them, they had an oral Torah, and they worked this out. And that's comfortable for them, because they've got both a written Torah, the Old Testament, and the oral Torah, and they came apparently to that conclusion. From my reading, that seems to be what they did, is reading and studying the very words of God, this is the new sacrifice, since we can't sacrifice in the temple. Yeah.
Wouldn't that be kind of similar to what they would do if they were in exile? That they wouldn't be able to sacrifice, but they would tell their children the stories, and they would pray, and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it could have been, you know, those ideas could have been all the way back from, you know, Jeremiah's time, where they're in Babylon. What do? Can't sacrifice. They can at least study the Torah. And you know, as we discussed, when we talked about the synagogue, when you get to the New Testament, there's synagogues everywhere, right? When you're in Jeremiah's time, there's synagogues exactly nowhere. And so sometime between the beginning of exile and the New Testament, synagogues as a practice exploded everywhere the Jews were. No one actually knows exactly how that worked. And when the first synagogue was made and all that, that's data that no one has. But they clearly went that way, because there's synagogues almost everywhere Paul ever goes in the book of Acts. There are synagogues there, and so clearly that means they've been around, not for 10 years, but probably for a few hundred years, you've got synagogues spreading. So, yeah, those ideas probably developed early, but that's one of the natures of the problems of the data. We don't really have that in intertestamental literature, that explanation, as far as I know. Where you get that explanation is from the rabbis, and the rabbis come from after this point. All of the Mishnah and whatnot, that comes later, and it's a difficulty, and it's a huge difficulty of going, okay, when you've got the later rabbis, a few hundred years after this point, next century, however you want to date them, and the various different ideas and whatnot, how far can you push that back? Can you push back the thoughts of the rabbis into the intertestamental period? And the answer is, sometimes you just can't, but what do you know that you can push back, and what do you know that you can? You can't and can. If something is also echoed within the intertestamental literature that you can date back to that time, you can push that back. But if you've got something that comes from the rabbis, like this notion, that doesn't show up in the intertestamental period, how far back can we push that in terms of their justification for, oh, well, we don't need a temple. We've got the Torah that we can study, and that solves the need for a sacrifice. So, It goes back, but we don't know how far it goes back. All those ideas could be pre-Jesus. They could be after. And those things developed as a part of the fact that, well, the Jerusalem temple was gone and they couldn't offer sacrifices there. There's lots of mystery there just from a historical standpoint. Yeah.
It makes sense, like with the diaspora and with having people all over, they would be too far away to go to Jerusalem, you know, every year like they're supposed to.
Yeah.
They have to find some way to still be good Jews because they don't have the money or the means.
That's true.
When they were in exile, people stayed and they still wanted to be.
Not every Jew can go to Jerusalem every year.
Anytime people spread super far, you have to find a way to do things.
Yeah. And they had their I think some of their way of dealing with that. And everybody has, I guess every religious group has some way of dealing with, if you have a text, how do you justify everything you think? They had oral Torah. They had the rabbis. They had, that's a fertile ground for speculation to come up with ideas to justify how you would do things.
I worked with two practicing Jews and I asked them the same question. By their answer, it seemed like they had never even considered the question. What do we do for sin? God knows this.
Right.
I was perplexed. Like, they had no knowledge, or at least, of the whole sacrificial system and atonement for sin with the blood offering.
Did they recognize the conundrum, or did they just go, not important?
Even asking, what do you do for sin, seems like a foreign question. They hadn't considered that they need to do something for sin. But this is common, it's all throughout the Old Testament. God is constantly reminding his people that he's given them a way to atone for what they've done. I would think Jews would know the Old Testament. Maybe they're just...
Well, lots of practicing Christians.
Sure.
Yeah. Same struggles there, right? Any other questions or thoughts or discussion on this? Okay, let's jump into the narrative, or I will fail once again to finish this. In terms of theology in the rest of the book, a lot of it is, it's all centered around the narrative of what happens to Paul in his trip to Rome. So you've got Paul arrested in the temple. So he's going to do this, and if you look at 21 verse 27, when the 7 days were almost completed, the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him. The Jews from Asia, who is this? Well, these are the people that were giving him trouble in Asia, right? In the other synagogues that he had been going around and preaching, they had come here and they seeing Paul, right? Because they're going to be very familiar with Paul at this point. They see him and they go, all right, we're going to stir up some, we're going to get this guy out of here, right? And so a false charge is brought up against Paul at this point. They had previously seen in verse 29, for they had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian with him in the city. And they had supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. All right, so Paul had not done this, but they supposed that Paul, well, he brought this Ephesian Gentile, I would assume here, into the city. He must have brought him into the temple. And they raise a total fuss. And so you've got here, still in chapter 21, there's a big event. The soldiers get called in. They basically, the soldiers came and they stopped to stop the beating of Paul there in verse 33. Then the tribune came up and arrested him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. He inquired who he was and what he had done. Interestingly enough, Paul's the one getting beaten, and so the tribune comes in and arrests Paul. What had Paul done wrong? Well, you know what? It's not such a big deal for them. It becomes a big deal when they find out that Paul's a Roman citizen. And at that point, they have to go, whoa, now we have to, cross our T's and dot our I's. Because if you're not a Roman citizen, it's just not that big of a deal if something like this happens. This whole, universal rights thing, not as quite of a big of a deal for them as it is for us. Anyway, so they basically arrest him, and Paul wants to speak to the crowd. And so you get that here in the very last verse of chapter 21. You know, and when there was a great hush, he addressed them in the Hebrew language, saying... Now, one thing that's interesting about this is you've got him basically being protected by Latin and Greek-speaking people. There's a decent chance that those protecting him would have no clue what Paul is saying at this point. All right. So it's like, let me speak to the people, and then blah 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 blah. What are they going to think while this is going on? Is he trying to incite some riot? They might actually have no way of knowing. Who knows how many of the Romans could have spoken Hebrew, or some would say this is actually talking about Aramaic. But anyway. So Paul addresses them and talks about his experience, about himself on the road to Damascus, and it ends here in verse 21 with a note that fits into one of the themes that we've been seeing over and over and over in Acts. The Jews are listening to Paul's description, but when Paul says one certain thing, they go bonkers. And that thing he says, "And he said to me, 'Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles.'" Up to this word, they listened to him, and this is verse 22. "Then they raised their voices and said, 'Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live.'" And so it's Paul's going through his narrative, and once he mentions the Gentile mission, they go crazy and say, "No, we don't want to listen to this guy anymore." And you've got, once again, Paul causing yet another riot. So they were getting upset. The Tribune at that point brings Paul back in, saying, "Okay, once again out of control. Let's bring him in." They're about to start whipping Paul to find out what he had done. When Paul says, "Really, should you be doing this? I am a Roman citizen." And at that point they go, "Well, we're in possible legal trouble here," and so they back off and treat him a little bit better. And everything from this point is on the basis of the fact that he's a Roman citizen. If you've got some random Jewish guy who's not a Roman citizen, they're not going to treat him like this. When he has issues and he says, I need you to protect me, they might just be no and off with him. But he's a Roman citizen. They can't treat him that way. So the next day, Paul goes before the council. And so the guy who's running the show here from the Roman standpoint takes Paul before the council because he wants to see more of what's going on. We see that in verse 30. "But on the next day, desiring to know the real reason while he was being accused by the Jews, he unbound him and commanded the chief priest and all the council to meet. And he brought Paul down and set him before them." So now, knowing that he's a Roman citizen, he really does need to find out what's going on. Is there actual legal charges here? And so they bring Paul down. You've got an interesting interaction here between Paul and, Paul says something, and he says something that's not entirely respectful to the chief priest. So they hit him, and he apologizes, actually, because he did not realize that he was talking to the chief priest, which is an interesting cultural moment there, at least in my mind. He ends this, and you'll see this as it comes up several times later on. He ends this, and I wonder if this is something I wonder if this is a tactic of, I've got Sadducees here, I've got Pharisees here, they're all critiquing me and causing sorts of issues. Tell you what, I'm just going to set them off against each other. And so that's what he does here after verse 6. Let's see. Yeah, let's read verse 6. "Now when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out into the council, 'Brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. It is with respect to the hope of and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial. And when he had seen this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. And you start getting Pharisees defending him because he's now set them off. He's basically... very suave move here, just go, "Hey, this is an issue. I'm going to get some allies," and you've got a fight there. So anyway, even when that ends, though, there's a number of Jews that decide they want to kill Paul. So you've got a number of people that take an oath saying that they will not eat nor drink until they killed Paul. Not sure how this turned out with them, because they did not succeed. And so they do a plot, and that's in 23 verse 12. It starts that discussion. They basically say, we're gonna take a vow until we murder Paul. And so what they want to do is they want to bring Paul once again to the council. And when he comes to the council, he's going to be less protected, and so it will be easier for them to kill Paul. And so Paul's, what is it, sister's son, right? Is that right? 16. The son of Paul's sister heard of the ambush and went and told Paul, and Paul said, okay, now go tell the Roman. And so the Roman says, okay, can't let this happen. This is a Roman citizen. So in the third hour of the night, they send Paul off to Caesarea. He is sent to Felix, the governor, where he is going to spend a couple of years awaiting trial. And so in verse 23, Paul is sent to Felix. A letter is sent, and if you read this letter, it doesn't quite fit the narrative that went before, which... Well, it makes the Roman ruler here, he makes himself sound a little bit too good, I think. Like, I'm protecting this Roman citizen, when it wasn't, in fact, he had to be told he was a Roman citizen and actually wasn't doing quite the right thing. It's like he's spackling over some of his own bad judgment there. But anyway, so Paul is sent to Felix, the governor. Now, the Romans that we're running into in Caesarea, they're going to be in line with Roman policy. They're going to protect Paul. They're going to make witnesses show up, and they're going to make a trial happen. They're not just going to let Paul die. Now, they're also, one of them's not going to be entirely upright, because he, as the text says, he kept Paul in prison for 2 years, hoping at some point that Paul would bribe him to get out. Paul never did it, so he ended up being in prison for 2 years, but that's kind of what he was hoping. So, you know, he's doing some things right, but maybe not everything. So Paul is before Felix in Caesarea. He is there for a couple of years. He gets a chance to talk to them. Later on, when basically he's there until Felix's time is up, and they send in someone else ultimately to run, and that would be Festus. And so when you get to, let's see, if you look at the very end of chapter 24, when 2 years had elapsed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and desiring to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison. So he didn't release Paul at that point. As it turns out, actually, Paul wanted to stay in prison because ultimately two things. One, if he got out of prison, he would be more susceptible for murder. And two, this was his vehicle to get to Rome, as we shall see in a second. So in chapter 25, Festus, whenever he comes to rule the area, goes down to Jerusalem. And when he's in Jerusalem, the Jews there bring up the case against Paul again, saying, look, we need to deal with this guy. And so then Festus goes up to Paul in Caesarea, and they have yet another case. And they can't make the case. But ultimately, you've got verse 11. This is Acts 25, verse 11. This is Paul. If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death. But if there is nothing to their charges against me, no one can give me up to them. That's what Paul's trying to avoid, being given up to them, because he would be murdered at that point. I appeal to Caesar. Then Festus, when he had conferred with his council, answered, to Caesar you have appealed, to Caesar you shall go. Now, Herod Agrippa and Bernice come in at this point, and they talk to Paul. And Paul talks very respectfully to Herod, talking about it. Herod is very aware of what the Christians, who the Christians are at this point, and according to at least how Paul talks to him, he talks to him very respectfully and says, yes, I know that you believe the prophets, I know you believe the law, and talks to Agrippa and Bernice about Christianity. And ultimately, at the end of it, Agrippa's like, you know what? There's nothing here to kill Paul on. We could have let him go, but he appealed to Caesar. And so he's kind of got to go at this point. The trial must ultimately move on. And that's in chapter 26. In verse 30, chapter 26, verse 30. Then the king rose, and the governor, and Bernice, and those who were sitting with them, and when they had withdrawn, they said to one another, "This man is doing nothing to deserve death or imprisonment." And Agrippa said to Festus, "This man could have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar." So at this point, he's sent away from Caesarea. Now he's starting his trip to Rome. And the trip to Rome is not uneventful, as I'm sure you recall. Paul sails, and apparently they don't quite sail at the right time of the year, because ultimately they get caught in a storm at the sea. And so in verse 13, you've got this in verse 20. So chapter 27, verse 13. "Now when the sea wind blew gently, supposing they had obtained their purpose, they weighed anchor and sailed along Crete close to the shore. But soon a tempestuous wind, called a northeaster, struck down from the land. When the ship was caught and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and were driven along." Presumably, Luke is there on the boat with Paul. And I kind of assume that because Paul is a Roman citizen, he's given a little bit more leeway in terms of who can spend time with him. I wonder what it would be like for him if he wasn't. But you've got later on when he gets to Rome, they don't keep Paul isolated in a cell the where he can't talk to people. People can come in and come out, and when we see there, he'll speak to the Jews and when he's in Rome. So you've got Luke apparently here with him as they go along. So there's the storm at the sea, and ultimately you get to the point where they all think they're going to die. They start throwing all their supplies overboard. They don't eat for a very long time, but they ultimately survive. And Paul tells them, you should. He says two things. "I told you so. You shouldn't have left at this point," because he did warn them that this is not the right time to leave. "And two, you will be saved as you follow his instructions." And so they are. They all do survive, and they ultimately shipwreck. You get that in chapter 27, verse 39. They strike a reef, and the ship breaks up, and basically they're stuck there at least for a little bit. So, not an easy trip to Rome, as it turns out. So here in chapter 28, you've got your very last chapter of Acts. We're going to do this. You've got your very last chapter of Acts. You've got Paul there. The only incident while he's on this island is when they're making a fire. He is bitten by a poisonous snake. And everybody's like, you know what? He just thought he got away from God's judgment, but he got bitten by a snake. He must be guilty of whatever it was. And of course, he lives through it. And the natural reaction, obviously, is, well, he must be a god. So, this is the ancient world. Gods are everywhere. Little g gods are everywhere. Here's somebody getting bitten by a snake. We all know what happens when these snakes bite people. People die. He didn't die, therefore he's not a person. I guess that's the reasoning. But ultimately, Paul gets off the off of Malta and does make it ultimately to Rome. And I want to read the very last section, and then we will be done. And this is in verse 17. "After 3 days, he called together the local leaders of the Jews. When they had gathered, he said to them, 'Brothers, though I had done nothing against our people or the customs of our fathers, yet I was delivered as a prisoner from Jerusalem into the hands of the Romans. And when they had examined me, they wished to set me at liberty because there was no reason for the death penalty in my case. But because the Jews objected, I was compelled to appeal to Caesar, though I had no charge to bring against my nation. For this reason, therefore, I have asked to see you and speak with you, and since it is because of the hope of Israel that I am wearing this chain.' And they said to him, 'Well, we received no letters from Judea about you, and none of the brothers coming here has reported or spoken any evil about you.' Maybe it's because they didn't receive any letters because the Jews gave up. It could be because, well, it wasn't the season for travel, as we saw, based on the shipwreck. Maybe they just hadn't had time and couldn't get letters all the way to Rome in time. Maybe they would have intended to go and chase Paul down even there. It's hard to say. But at the very least, these Jews didn't know any bad things about Paul. But they did know about Christianity. But we desire to hear from you," this is verse 22, "what your views are, for with regard to this sect..." Christianity. We know that everywhere it is spoken against. When they appointed a day for him, they came to him at his lodging in great numbers. From morning till evening he expounded to them, testifying to the kingdom of God and trying to convince them about Jesus, both from the law of Moses and from the prophets. And some were convinced by what he said, but others disbelieved. And disagreeing with themselves, they departed after Paul had made one statement. The Holy Spirit was right in saying to your fathers through Isaiah the prophet, go to this people and say, you will indeed hear, but never understand. And this is from, as it says, Isaiah. You will indeed see, but never perceive, for this people's heart has grown dull. And with their ears they can barely hear, and their eyes they have closed, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their heart and turn, and I would heal them. Therefore, let it be known to you that this salvation of God has been sent to the Gentiles. They will listen. And he lived there 2 whole years at his own expense and welcomed all who came to him, proclaiming the kingdom of God and teaching about the Lord Jesus Christ with all boldness and without hindrance. Without hindrance, meaning he was quite accessible and able to talk to people despite the fact that he was awaiting trial. So Luke ends on really his main subject that he had in both the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts. It's this God is working in Jesus, bringing about the kingdom of God and welcoming the Gentiles into it, right? Here up until the very end. So that's the book of Acts. If you have anything you want more to discuss about the book of Acts, bring it up next time, because we do need to end for today. After that discussion, if there's any discussion there, we will start our study through the book of Paul's epistles. We will start with what are generally recognized as Paul's earliest epistles, the epistles of 1 and 2 Thessalonians. Okay? So that's what we'll start with next time.
Does anybody else Bible open chapter 29? In the NIV Bible, there's a note at the bottom. Some manuscripts say after he said this, Jews left arguing vigorously among themselves.
I haven't seen
it. So I'm not sure that particular line is.
Right. Okay, let's dismiss and go next door. Mike, will you pray for us, please?
Our services will go forward.